Coming up next, Upstate's HealthLink on Air. On this week's show, we talked to a patient and surgeon about a tricky diagnosis that led them to the adrenal gland.
I noticed I was having severe headaches, heart palpitations, sweating, back pain. I was anxious. I had a little bit of depression, and I had this feeling that I was going to die.
That the case of adrenal tumors, while they may be quote-unquote non-malignant, they can still be very active hormonally, meaning that they will produce lots and lots and lots of substances.
Plus, an update and some answers about Lyme disease.
It starts initially by somewhat nonspecific symptoms. In very early stages of infection, one cannot tell whether a patient has Lyme disease.
We'll get our checkup from the neck up and a selection from our healing muse, and they're all coming up right after the news. This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On this week's show, we take a closer look at the controversial problem of Lyme disease. But first, a new treatment for adrenal gland tumors and what it means. Well, in the past, most patients with small adrenal masses would undergo total removal of their adrenal glands, called an adrenalectomy. However, today there's a new, less invasive procedure that's now being used to correct this problem with very encouraging results. Here to tell us more about all of this is Dr. Gennady Bratslavsky. He's the chairman of urology at Upstate Medical University, and joining us is Erica Searles. She's a patient who has successfully experienced this procedure. Welcome to you both. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
So, Dr. Bratslavsky, let's begin by helping us all understand what exactly are the adrenal glands and why are they important?
Adrenals are a parent organ that is anatomically located inside the body. They both live right above the kidneys, kind of towards your back, but more towards the middle of the body. They are exceedingly important for our everyday function, and they produce something known as hormones. Depending on which part of the adrenal is active at each given moment, we have appropriate fine balance of these hormones to help us with numerous functions: control of our salt, control of our sugar, even control of some of our sex hormones, and including of our survival, flight, or fight hormones that are also made in the adrenal to allow us to maintain our blood pressure, sometimes even regulate our heart rate.
So things like epinephrine, norepinephrine, androgens, estrogens, aldosterone, cortisol, those are all the hormones that are made by the adrenals.
Estrogen is typically made in ovaries, but some of the pre-estrogen precursors and some of the hormonal other hormones that you have mentioned are made in the adrenals.
So are the adrenal glands essential for life?
Absolutely. The person would not be able to survive without the hormones made by adrenals for more than 24 hours.
So you mentioned that they're paired. So much like the kidneys, there are two of them?
That is correct. Paired means two of them, like one on the left and one on the right.
Okay. So what are these tumors of the adrenals? Why do they occur? What causes them? And in effect, are they life-threatening?
So the multitude or variety of tumors in adrenals are enormous. In terms of anything from the size of the tumors to location of the tumors to the function of these tumors. As I mentioned earlier, adrenal has several layers to it. While the gland is quite small and the size of it is maybe a couple of inches in the longest dimension, although a very thin couple of inches, there are several layers, and each one, as I mentioned, is responsible for a certain type of hormones. Therefore, tumors will make often these hormones depending on where in the layer of the adrenals they appear. While on the examination with your eyes or on a regular scan, such as a CAT scan or some specialized X-ray, one may see that it appears to be very homogeneous, or I would say very uniform in its shape and appearance. Inside, it's a very, very complex gland.
So exactly. So you're saying that it's small, it's quite complex. Depending on the layer, it produces different hormones, the balance of which are essential for life. But what causes the tumors? Are these tumors benign generally, malignant generally? And if left untreated, do they go on to basically threaten one's life?
Yeah, these are all outstanding questions. So first of all, there is a variety in terms of being benign or malignant of these tumors in the adrenals. The vast majority of these tumors are benign, although when the tumors may reach certain size, depending on where they are, they can spread.
And can they therefore, even if they're benign, they could interrupt the functioning of the adrenal?
Absolutely. By being benign, it does not mean that it is quiet.
Or harmless.
Being benign, by definition, means that it does not spread or has not spread yet. But in the case of adrenal tumors, while they may be quote-unquote non-malignant, they can still be very active hormonally, meaning that they will produce lots and lots and lots of substances that can very negatively affect somebody's blood pressure, heart function, salt balance, sugar balance, weight, bone density, eye exam. So there are many, many things that can become extremely harmful from dysregulation or from these tumors.
So Erica, getting to you, thank you so much for coming here to talk to about your experience. What were you experiencing when you first started having issues? Tell us about that in terms of symptoms and what it felt like to you, and tell us your story.
Thank you. About a year ago, I noticed I was having severe headaches, heart palpitations, sweating, back pain. I was anxious. I had a little bit of depression, and I had this feeling that I was going to die, just this impending doom feeling. And then a year ago, this month, I went into heart failure. Ended up in the hospital for a week. And
so this wasn't all in your head?
It was not all in my head. No. I did think it was all in my head during the months previous to this. The heart failure was originally called Takotsubo cardiomyopathy. My heart was misshapen. But what had happened was...
And let me just interrupt you. You had no prior history of any kind of cardiac issues prior to this?
None whatsoever.
So this kind of came out of the blue for you?
Yeah, out of the blue, completely. And it, as we know now, it was because of the hormone disruption. The extra adrenaline running through my system was what triggered the heart failure. I was home recovering for months and months and just wasn't feeling myself as I should have.
Let me back up a little bit. So you had all these symptoms. What led you to know that you had a problem with your heart? Did you feel like you were having a heart attack at one point?
Yep. Yes. January 28th of last year. Yes. I just felt like I was having a heart attack. I had sweating and chest pain, terrible chest pain, and all of the typical symptoms, nausea.
And what did you do then?
My husband took me to the hospital and I was admitted and they did an angio to look at my heart and discovered, and an echo also, and they discovered.
Do you mind my asking? You don't have to tell me exactly, but how old are you or were you at the time?
I was 44 at the time.
Okay, so in a way, very unusual to have a heart attack. Well, I guess these days more women are having these kinds of
episodes. I had clear arteries, low blood pressure, no indication at all that I should have any heart issues.
And so what happened when you got to the hospital or following that?
I was sent home on beta blockers, which is a medication to regulate my heart. I took those for at least 6 months.
So you recuperated from that incident.
Mm-hmm.
Did they have any sense of why you had this problem?
No. A cardiomyopathy like that happens. It's a stress cardiomyopathy. So it's if someone's home burns down or they lose a child, this it can be a a sudden onset of this.
So a reaction, that whole flight or fight, which is what Dr. Retzlosky was talking about, could be going full bore and cause a change in your heart.
Yes, and I didn't have any of those symptoms or any of those
occurrences
that would have caused that to happen. So, yeah, they were a little baffled by what it was. I also had low blood pressure, and generally, the pheochromocytoma would present with high blood pressure, and I had very low blood pressure. So
we
went
for
months without any reason that this had happened, but I was recovering, just wasn't feeling quite myself, and went back to the cardiologist and asked, I just want to make sure I'm doing okay. He put me on more beta blockers, which I think may have made me more sick. I'm not sure that was the right thing with the pheo. And I found, I found a correlation between pheochromocytoma and adrenal tumors. So
the pheochromocytoma is referencing what happened to your heart.
Yes.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And you saw somewhere in some literature that you could have had some kind of adrenal problem causing it.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
And then?
Mm-hmm. So then I went to my primary care physician and asked him to run a 24-hour urine test, which is the first test that you have done for this. He did it and called me a couple days later and said, Mrs. Searles, you have a tumor. I cheered because I was very excited to have an answer. I found a surgeon in Rochester, New York, who would take me on and do a total adrenalectomy. And then, as luck would have it, my daughter and I were doing some further research, and we found that Upstate was having an international conference on this very topic, and we found Dr. Bretzlowski, who does partials. So I'm very happy to have not had a total adrenalectomy with a very large scar. I have a few tiny little scars, and I have my adrenal gland left, so I'm very excited.
Well, let's go back to you, Dr. B. So basically, why... is it, well, first of all, if you can't exist without your adrenals, obviously a total adrenalectomy doesn't mean both are taken.
That is correct. Usually only one.
Only one, assuming the tumor is only in one.
Correct.
All right. In this case, why would you want to do a partial? And tell us a little bit about what the standard has always been in terms of the total.
So the standard for many, many years has been a total removal of adrenal gland in case the tumor is found that needs to come out. Also, standard procedure for many, many years was a procedure through a big incision, known as open total adrenalectomy.
So you basically do a large incision, it's a long operation,
and it's a longer recovery.
A longer recovery, which is always the case with open versus these less invasive.
Less minimally invasive. And of course, with minimally invasive surgeries, many have been performing adrenal surgery now without making these big open scars. But the concept of partial adrenalectomy or removal of a tumor with leaving a normal portion of the adrenal has really not penetrated the urologic or surgical practices worldwide as commonly as we wished.
Now, you had experience in your earlier years in training with this exact procedure. Tell us about that.
That is correct. Back at the National Cancer Institute or National Institutes of Health, where I have done my fellowship in urologic oncology and later actually stayed as a senior surgeon on staff there, I have done many of these procedures.
The partial
procedures.
So that was gaining traction or interest within the NCI, within the National Cancer Institute.
That is correct. And maybe in a few centers worldwide. There was one center in Germany that was performing these procedures. There were a center in Japan, one in Austria. But usually the standard of care has been remaining the removal of the entire adrenal. And your question is, why remove the tumor and not remove the whole adrenal if you have the other adrenal left in place? And it addresses your earlier question, for which I have not really given a full answer, is what is causing these adrenal tumors? What we're learning now is, in Erica's case, something like pheochromocytoma. We used to think that only 10% of those were caused by the specific genetic mutation. As we're learning now, the genes or alterations in the quote-unquote genetic code may be responsible for much larger percent of these tumors to appear. Especially in younger men and women, we are learning that the earlier onset of this problem means that there is a higher chance that the other side may also be affected and may also develop tumors later on in life. That would certainly make the procedure much more challenging, as it may lead to a removal of the other side, and in that case would render patient be without adrenals, requiring lifelong medications to be alive.
Hold that thought. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen, along with urologist Dr. Gennady Bratzlavsky and patient Erica Searles. We're talking about a new, lesser invasive procedure to treat tumors of the adrenal glands. So if you had to take, if you did an adrenalectomy, a full adrenalectomy on her to start, the chances are greater with this kind of a case that she could develop some tumors of the other adrenal gland, and you would basically render her without adrenals. Eventually, you might have to.
That is correct. Nobody has a crystal ball today to predict which of the patients that develop tumor on one adrenal gland would develop tumors on the other side. Another important point is to understand that adrenal glands are not a safe organ. They are often an organ that is affected by numerous conditions, anything from infection to trauma to, God forbid, the metastasis from many, many other organs.
So they can basically be the subject of, they can be affected by other cancers
that
within the
exactly
body.
That is exactly correct. Other cancers and numerous conditions. In several papers and manuscripts and book chapters that I have published on this very topic, I actually have a very specific table that often refers to the fact that adrenal glands are not safe. And just by because you remove one and leave the quote-unquote normal adrenal gland behind, the life chance of a patient experiencing something happening to the adrenal is still not insignificant. It still is, you know, 1 in 100 to 1 in 50 people will be affected. And while indeed the chances are small, somebody wins a lottery, and the 1 in 50 to 1 in 100 chance is actually not that small when you look at the medical populations, those that potentially may require lifelong medications.
So when you say that, I wanted to understand that a little better. So the consequence of having to basically remove both adrenal glands in the worst case scenario would mean the person could survive, but they would have to be on a full regimen of lifelong hormones, is that it?
That is exactly correct. The lifelong regimen of hormones. And we have certainly gotten much better in terms of hormonal replacement in case of those patients that have no adrenal surgery. Except hormones are given once or twice a day. And this is not how adrenals work. They work to a point of milliseconds, adjusting to threats that we experience, adjusting to outside environment, adjusting to controlling the needs of our bodies. So one of my slides that I have in my talks is do not get stressed, because adrenal hormones are replaced twice a day. It's not like we get stressed twice a day. Our human body undergoes stress numerous times.
So it's a less satisfactory way to live. I mean, it's you can exist, you can live, but basically if you're on a full-time regimen of these hormones, it doesn't really replicate what the normal natural cycle is.
Correct. But other than satisfaction, it could be life-threatening. Because if somebody is about to start experiencing an illness, undergoes an emergent procedure, has a virus even, if the adrenal replacement or this hormone replacement is not adequate, that is needed for the body, many people end up hospitalized, and this is something known as Edisonian crisis, still associated with about 3% chance of dying from this.
So the bottom line is it leaves you very vulnerable
That is correct.
If you were to have to remove both adrenals. And in this case, by doing the partial, you're really continuing to keep the healthy part of that gland intact.
That is correct.
So what else was kind of groundbreaking about doing it this way? I mean, the idea of using the minimally invasive approach you said has been done for a total adrenalectomy. Was it very difficult to do a partial under those circumstances?
Yeah, so in Erica's case, the tumor that she had is typically located in the heart of the adrenal, right in the middle. So the location of it makes it extremely challenging. Also, this tumor was located behind the largest vein in the body, called vena cava, and we had to perform some important surgical maneuvers to get it. Additionally, we have done it with a robotic assistance, something that we certainly can offer. And in the follow-up imaging and the hormonal tests, we were very pleased to see perfectly looking residual or remaining adrenal gland, even though right now there is no tumor and the patient, Erica, did have the surgery. We are able to see, and I would have never guessed that she had a tumor on the side that was operated on. So right now, she can live her normal life without being threatened, if God forbid, the tumor is to develop on the other side.
Wow, that's wonderful news. Erica, how are you feeling?
I feel fabulous, thank you.
Tell me what changed following your surgical recuperation.
What did you notice? I have no headaches. I have not had a headache since the surgery on September 14th, and it is life-changing. I just feel at peace, and I have my life back.
Well, that's very exciting news. And do you see, very little time we have left, Dr. Baslavsky, do you see this as significant in terms of the future of other kinds of minimally invasive techniques? Does this kind of add to the armamentarium of people making that case?
Yeah, I certainly think that the minimally invasive surgery is here to stay. We do have a very active ongoing robotic program at the upstate, anywhere from urologic oncology to hepatobiliary surgery to general surgery to otolaryngology, ENT, where the minimally invasive surgery is performed. The fact that we were able to get Erica out of the hospital in less than 48 hours was admirable. The fact that she had such a recovery was very encouraging.
Well, it's very encouraging, very exciting news. Thank you both so much for sharing that with me. My guest has been Dr. Gennady Bratzlavsky, the chairman of urology at Upstate Medical University, and Erica Searles, a patient. Thanks so much for coming in. I'm Linda Cohen. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Up next, the controversy over chronic Lyme disease and some answers. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen here with you. Well, each year, approximately 30,000 cases of Lyme disease are reported to the Centers for Disease Control by state health departments. However, this number does not reflect every case of Lyme disease that's diagnosed in the United States every year. The number has risen steadily since 1995, when there were only 11,700 confirmed cases. The disease and its treatments remain somewhat controversial. And here with the facts that you should know about Lyme disease are Dr. Caitlin Scarlett, assistant professor of pediatrics specializing in rheumatology and integrative medicine, and Dr. Yana Shaw, associate professor of pediatrics specializing in infectious diseases, both from Upstate Medical University. Welcome to you both. Thanks for coming in to talk to us about this very important topic.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for coming.
So, Dr. Shaw, let's start by defining what we mean when we say Lyme disease. What is it?
Lyme disease is an infection. It's caused by a bacteria that's called Borrelia burgdorferi, and it's an illness that have somewhat predictable manifestation. It starts initially by somewhat nonspecific symptoms. In very early stages of infection, one cannot tell whether a patient has Lyme disease, but as the infection progresses, the most characteristic feature is a rash. It's the bullseye rash that's typically referred to. If the infection is not treated at the early stages, the infection will spread, and some patients will develop multiple circular lesions. For some patients, the infection will go into the central nervous system and can cause facial weakness, facial droop. It can cause inflammation of the brain or spinal cord, referred to as meningitis. In some patients, it does go into the heart and can cause carditis or symptoms of fast heart rate or passing out. One of the most common manifestations of Lyme disease is joint disease, which manifests not only by joint pain, but also joint swelling.
So basically what has happened is a person has been exposed to a bacteria called Bacteria Borrelia burgdorferi, I guess, and that's named after the person who actually founded it or discovered it. But I think his name is Willie Burgdorfer, which is interesting. But what exactly is happening? How did they get the disease to begin with? I think most people know that there is an association mm-hmm. between the deer tick mm-hmm. and the disease. Tell us a little bit more about that.
That's correct. So the infection is transmitted by ticks, deer ticks. Our area, New York, Connecticut, Maryland, Massachusetts, Northeast, Mid-Atlantic, and Central Northern regions are particularly heavily infested with this bacteria, and the deer tick transmits the infection to humans. So the infection is transmitted upon the bite of a tick. And, you know, the tick bite alone is not a risk for transmission. It's the length of the tick attachment that increases the risk of infection.
So in other words, if you were bitten and somehow saw the tick immediately and were able to either flick it off or remove it, the chances of transmission of the disease are far less.
Probably zero. The studies have very careful studies have looked at the risk of transmission with the time of attachment, and they did find out that you need at least 36 hours of the tick's attachment to transmit the bacteria to humans.
It's interesting because you were mentioning where it's most prevalent, and it's named. The whole name is Lyme disease, and that's after basically Lyme, Connecticut, and that must have been a focus or a focal point where a lot of these cases were first discovered.
Right.
But so mostly it's found in the upper Northeast and the upper in the Northeast and the upper Midwest mm-hmm. in this country at this point. Yes,
yeah.
Dr. Scarlett.
Alan Steer was a doctor in Lyme, Connecticut who initially discovered Lyme disease in a group of children, actually, that were thought to have one of the diseases I treat called juvenile idiopathic arthritis. There was a group of children. They thought they had this chronic arthritis, and he did some investigation and eventually discovered that they had this arthritis from Lyme disease.
So in other words, that was how this... So it was thought of as more of a chronic disease initially. From these arthritic symptoms.
Exactly.
But they finally kind mm-hmm. of fine-tuned it down to that it was this bacterium that was infecting mm-hmm. people. So basically... At this point, what are the things that basically what are the most important things for people to know in terms of discovering Lyme disease on them? I mean, what kinds of symptoms should they be looking for? Because what you said initially is it is not always immediately apparent that someone has Lyme disease until the disease progresses. Well, that's problematic in that mm-hmm. once it progresses, there are obviously more, greater consequences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I would encourage parents who will find tick on their child or adults if they find tick to gently remove it. And CDC has excellent information on how to safely remove ticks.
That you can find online.
Online, that's correct. However, after that, you should observe yourself carefully for symptoms such as rash. And I would like to remind the listeners the rash can be very faint. I had numerous patients whose parents obviously were very careful and were educated, were looking for it, but still would have missed the rash. Because
so it's not always, just to interrupt you, I'm sorry, but it's mm-hmm. not always that basically that red bullet type of like the Target ads, mm-hmm. you know, with a real kind of bullseye. It can be something very more, much more subtle.
Right. The rash can be very faint. It can have this salmon color appearance, and it just can be a ring, and the ring grows bigger and it can get quite extensive. So especially as children get older and they bathe themselves and parents do not get to get close inspection of their skin, it can easily be missed. In fact, 50% of patients who do have Lyme disease report never remembering having rash.
So that's I think it leads to some of the big concern, Dr. Scala, in terms of this whole issue of certain symptoms showing up, like with these children at the very initial phase that you mentioned in Lyme, Connecticut. They showed symptoms. It was assumed it was something more of a chronic disease, and there was no an initial association between that and the disease, right. the bacterium.
Right. The symptoms of Lyme disease can be very flu-like at first. So, yes, there is the rash, but I find that too. About 50% of patients, parents do not, you know, they never identify this rash, but the patients can have flu-like symptoms, aches and pains, and, you know, feel fatigue, you know, in the days, even weeks after initial infection. Now, the signs of arthritis often come months, even years after the initial infection.
I'm going to get to that in a minute, but how is this diagnosed then effectively? In other words, you already, Dr. Shaw mentioned that mm-hmm. it's somewhat hard to diagnose, can take quite a while to know that you really have it. So how is it definitively diagnosed?
So as with any testing for Lyme disease especially, you want to make sure you're testing patients who are likely to have Lyme disease. So for example, if a patient has facial droop or has meningitis or has arthritis, as Dr. Scarlett mentioned, we have excellent testing available to us. It's a blood draw that looks actually at the antibody protections that the body's immune responses to the bacteria. So we have those tests. There are some other culture-based method and sort of molecular PCR-based methods. All those tests are available to us, but the key to remember for testing is just make sure we test patients who are likely to have Lyme disease.
Why is that? Tell me more about that.
Because there are, the tests are so sensitive that sometimes they can mislabel patients as having Lyme disease
when they actually false positive.
Correct.
And, you know, both Dr. Scarlett and myself, we have seen a number of patients who were falsely labeled as having Lyme disease because they were tested at times where they should not have been tested, where they had these vague, non-specific subjective symptoms for months and years, and their laboratory testing was inaccurately interpreted as abnormal.
For how long after the symptoms show would a test show positive, I guess, is the question, and be accurately positive? I think this is where there's a cloud a little bit over this disease because of the confusion in terms of when to test, when it will show, who to test, and what the potential for false positives.
So in general, it takes at least 4 weeks for the laboratory testing to test positive. At that time, if you have a facial droop or you have joint disease, you have arthritis, at that time, person should be positive by testing. Plus, we have what's called two-tier testing available. So when the screening test is positive, we run confirmatory testing.
Is that the same test repeated or something different?
It's something different. That test actually looks at detailed at the antibodies that are produced by patients to make sure that we are actually dealing with a patient who has Lyme disease.
So that's my question, I guess, Dr. Scala. Do you feel at this point we have the science in place to definitively diagnose someone as either having had Lyme or not?
Absolutely. Absolutely, I do. And that goes for patients who are presenting with symptoms earlier. You know, sometimes, as Dr. Shaw noted, it does take several weeks for the testing to become positive. So, you know, in very limited circumstances, sometimes a patient will have to be tested again if it's been in that short window. But as she also noted, you should test patients, you know, appropriately choose who you test for this disease. But also patients who have long-term late consequences of the Lyme disease, these tests adequately capture those patients.
So let's say you have symptoms months or years later. are you saying at that point those antibodies will still be present in the blood?
Yes, the long-term antibodies, if it's a late complication, such as the patients I often see, the patients with Lyme arthritis.
So you can at that later date definitively diagnose.
Yes.
That's very helpful information. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen, along with pediatric rheumatologist Dr. Caitlin Scarlett and pediatric infectious disease specialist Dr. Yana Shaw. And we're talking about Lyme disease. That gets me to the, let me talk a little bit about this whole notion of prevention, because I want you to take us through what happens when you find, if a parent or an individual should suspect that they've been bitten by a tick. But back up for a minute. It seems to me that prevention is probably the key to most of this, with all of us living in a climate and an environment with so many ticks, deer ticks around. Tell us about what your thoughts are about prevention, either of you.
Well, I think prevention is absolute key with this disease, especially as you just noted, in our area with our high deer population here. So it's very important for patients, for parents, especially parents with small children, that they dress to make sure when they go out, out into the yard, out into wooded areas, that they wear, even in the summertime, long sleeves, long pants, even though lightweight. And when they come back inside, to check their body, do a full body check to look for any ticks. Because as Dr. Shaw noted, if you can early identify a tick and remove it, then the likelihood of the transmission is, basically 0%.
So let's take us through the steps. Let's say I'm out in the yard with my child. I come in and I find that there's a tick. It's quite small. It's not swollen. I can be sure that I bathed them a night before and I didn't see it then. So I know that it's a fairly recent phenomenon. So what is the recommendation at that point? You take it off carefully. Go on,
Dr.
Shaw.
Yeah, I would take tweezers, and you want to grab the tick at the very bottom by close to the skin and gently pull up. You don't want to apply nail polish. You don't want to burn off the ticks. You don't want to choke them. Those are all methods that actually can stress the tick, and that at that time it may expel the bacteria into your skin. So just a gentle pull with the tweezers, and cleaning the skin with alcohol afterwards is all that is needed.
But is it necessary at that point to have the tick tested, for example? I mean, these are some things that I've heard in the kind of general, atmosphere. Is it important to somehow then send the tick to a lab? Is it important at that point to see your physician, get some blood testing?
No, absolutely not. Not if you found a tick and you're sure that it wasn't on for the, the 24 to 36 hours. But I would definitely watch the child very closely and, just in case, look for the rash, look for flu-like symptoms, and just be aware that if any of these, symptoms do occur, then you can call your primary care physician.
So at that point, what you're suggesting is treatment is not necessary at that moment in time.
No, absolutely not.
So then what are the treatments and when are they appropriate, Dr. Shaw?
So the treatment for Lyme disease consists of antibiotics. The antibiotics that are extremely effective in treating this infection, this bacteria, let's remember, comes from ticks and deers, animals that are insects that are not typically fed antibiotics, so we really don't see any resistance.
So they can be very effectively killed.
Very effectively killed, and especially with children, which is the population that we treat. I've personally had a lot of excellent experience with treating Lyme disease. So the commonly used antibiotics, amoxicillin, doxycycline, cefuroxime, are effective, and children recover nicely and have excellent prognosis.
And what kind of a term of antibiotics are you using to treat it?
So they are, depending on what type, where the infection is, we would use oral antibiotics, or if you catch the infection in the heart or in the central nervous system, we would use parenteral IV antibiotics.
So IV, basically IV. Putting it into the bloodstream. But how long, and again, is all that dependent on the individual symptoms?
Yes.
It depends on the site of infection, 2 to 4 weeks.
So when you say it's effective, does it reverse? I mean, I understand it's effective in killing the bacteria, but when you've had it go on perhaps for a while, Dr. Scarlett, and I don't mean months and months, but even for a period of time enough so that it's somehow finding its way to other organs in the body or creating some kind of rheumatism or arthritis, does the treatment reverse these symptoms?
Yes, absolutely. In most of the cases, the treatment does reverse these symptoms, even with the late-term arthritis that I often see in my clinic. And, you know, we use the same antibiotics, amoxicillin, doxycycline, and generally the treatment time period depends on, like Dr. Shaw said, you know, what symptoms are involved. So with arthritis, for example, we start off with 4 weeks of antibiotic therapy in conjunction with an anti-inflammatory usually. And I have wonderful results with that, you know, with that treatment regimen with these patients with arthritis.
So where is all the controversy around this notion of chronic Lyme disease? Does it exist? In other words, are there sequelae? Do people continue after being treated? Let's say it's been diagnosed appropriately, definitively diagnosed, they've been given treatment. Do they continue to suffer with symptoms? And if so, why?
So very small proportion of patients who had Lyme disease and were appropriately treated will go on having what we call subjective symptoms. They will feel tired, they will have joint pain, not necessarily swelling, but pain. And that those complaints or symptoms will last for months. You know, at this point, we do not understand what causes those symptoms. There are some hypotheses out there that believe that this might be body's response to the treated infection. Those symptoms do not benefit from additional antibiotic therapy. So we strongly discourage repeated courses of antibiotics because carefully designed studies have looked at it and found that they are not effective. And in fact, they actually distract us from the appropriate treatment, which is a supportive care, symptomatic care, which Dr. Scarlett actually helps us with.
Now, you've seen a number of cases of this where these symptoms have continued on after a successful course of treatment. Let me ask you this. Do you check, do you do that kind of blood test following a course of treatment to determine if, in fact, you've killed the bacteria?
No, because all of the research shows that with these appropriate treatments, the bacteria are gone and, you know, the Lyme is treated. Now, we do see in a small percentage of these patients, these symptoms linger. So as Dr. Shaw said, you know, sometimes we have these patients with lingering arthralgia, which is subjective joint pain, or myalgia, muscle pain, or headaches, or fatigue. And in those cases, you know, it's not an actual chronic Lyme disease, that term is out there in the regard that it's not a chronic infection. But there, I do think that there is this syndrome, like in the literature, it's coined post-treatment Lyme disease syndrome. And it's very much like amplified pain syndrome. That's a pain syndrome that I see in a lot of my patients, that sometimes it occurs after, you know, and some kind of inflammation in the body, and that's treated. And then these patients go on to have pain syndromes. And sometimes it's, you know, pain syndromes from something else, from, you know, a psychiatric reason or a psychosomatic reason. And the treatment in those patients is important, because these patients do go on to have these symptoms. And I treat them in a very integrative approach. So things like manual medicine, so things like physical therapy, occupational therapy, exercise, even osteopathy. You know, mind-body medicine is very important in this treatment for these patients. So things like, you know, yoga, relaxation techniques with visual imagery, meditation is very important. Even things such as acupuncture and aromatherapy helps in these cases, as well as counseling. That's a very big part of it. I'm not saying that these symptoms aren't there. They're just not from an active disease. It's very important that we recognize that these patients have these symptoms and treat them appropriately, but they don't need to be on these long-term antibiotic therapies. And Dr. Shaw and I have both seen patients that have been either diagnosed appropriately and treated for Lyme disease, but for some reason are on long-term antibiotics, you know, for the notion of they think they were told that they have chronic Lyme disease because they have these lingering symptoms, or even patients that were misdiagnosed with Lyme disease that are on long-term, I mean, months and months and months of antibiotic therapies. That's it's inappropriate, because there are risks to being on antibiotics, and these patients, they're not getting better on these long-term antibiotics.
I think that's a key point, and I don't want to run out of time. So just to summarize, what I guess I'm hearing is prevention, if at all possible, early diagnosis, or as early as possible, being aware of the symptoms, checking it out, getting appropriate treatment, and if you should experience longer-term symptoms, there are methodologies such as integrative medicine, other ways to somehow treat those symptoms, but it's not long-term antibiotic therapy.
Absolutely.
Am I correct?
Yes.
Thank you so much. It's a very interesting and complex topic. Thank you both so much for coming in. My guests have been Dr. Caitlin Scarlett, Assistant Professor of Pediatrics specializing in rheumatology, and Dr. Yana Shaw, Associate Professor of Pediatrics specializing in infectious diseases at Upstate Medical University. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Hi, I'm psychologist Dr. Rich O'Neill with this week's checkup from the neck up. 30 years to climb a ladder, or it doesn't get any better than this. Well, folks, typing this, I was in the passenger seat, a very happy guy, and my wife, Pammy, is our very happy driver with a load of stuff in the back. And guess where we're going? Vacation? No. Visiting friends and family? No. Well, sort of. Okay, I'll tell, but first, a little story. My family was lower middle class. When I was applying to college to take a step up, Mom and Dad, who were big on education, said, "You'll never get into Yale, my dream school." They thought you only got Ivy League if your family was rich or famous or politically connected. And you know, they were sort of right in a big picture way. Well, I didn't get in because I was just a good student in high school, and you needed to be a really good student to go Ivy. New research shows, even though the U.S. is a land of opportunity, and the reason my dad immigrated here from Irish hunger, the fact is that the social class you're born into here more or less determines the social class you'll spend your life in. Stepping up much is not likely. And the research shows, surprisingly, upward mobility here is less likely than in many other countries. We beat the authoritarian regimes, of course, but we're behind even England, land of the aristocracy and landed gentry and all of that. Why isn't clear. But luckily, earlier research has shown the surest way to success here, with accompanying happier, healthier, less chance of disability, and a longer life, is education. Of course, my mom and dad had chanted to get a good job, get a good education, but how to make that happen? Well, in the meantime, scientists have found good stuff about growing kids to take a step up. What helps? Talking to our kids when they're babies from pop-out day, a lot. The more the better, describing the world and how it works. And being caring to them, letting them know in a zillion ways that they are the best thing in the world. And reading to them, and reading to them, and reading to them, and having books around the house. And not just telling them to read, but showing them by reading ourselves and showing up at their school and helping with the homework and helping with the homework and helping with the homework. These all make a difference. Now, my folks did some of that the best they could under their circumstances. And when I got to college, not Yale, boo-hoo, I did crack, crack, crack those books, books, books. Later, my wife and I did all the above. And now, we're whistling down the road to son's move-in to Harvard Law School. Yeah, wow. He's a really smart, friendly, loving guy who, with a lot of goodnight moons and PTA meetings and soccer games, worked to the top of the education ladder. Except for Yale, of course. And wow, look at that. What a feeling. But that's enough admiring the view. Gotta unload grandma's old kitchen table, my extra bike and his helmet, gonna need that brain, tennis racket, trail mix, etc., for the road ahead. And, yeah, I did get the t-shirt. Hope to see you at graduation.
And And now, Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate Medical University's literary and visual arts journal, The Healing Muse, with this week's selection.
Thank you, Linda. Jack Hopper is the poet laureate of Tompkins County. He sent us a beautiful portrait of his mother that not only brings her to life, but illustrates some of the good parts of aging. Here is the first 100 years. The empty wheelchair faces the door like a dog that wants out. My mother's gone to hospice where people pass away. But not gently, she, too feisty with her tiny fists, and most her silence, a wall raised against that one unwanted visitor. Long before her last hurrah, how many dances with Big Jack, her husband, who would die too young. Their parties rocked the house and kept us kids entranced behind the upstairs banister. In the mornings came the calm of Clair de Lune, played on her grand, as outside air fanned away the clouds of nicotine. Not till her last decade did her quick step falter. The only walker she preferred was Johnny on the rocks. The legacy of smoking, plastic lines of oxygen coiling, slithering on the floor around her, costing falls and fractures. Finally, liver cancer that no splint could fix entered without bothering to knock. And in the mix of nurses, friends, relations, came the ambulance, weeks later, driven by a handsome paramedic who caught her eye, his wink. With such feints, she kept at bay her aging enemy till the last day, then turning to the wall, passed through.
Thank you for joining us for HealthLink On Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Please join us again next week when we explore the growing epidemic of obesity in school-aged children, plus the risk of high cholesterol in kids. And it's how we talk the talk that matters. If you'd like to listen again to tonight's show, you can find a podcast of it on iTunes. Just search for HealthLink On Air. That's all one word. And to keep up with all the goings-on at Upstate, you can look for us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter, or check out the What's Up at Upstate blog at upstate.edu/whatsup. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.